Monroeville is like kind of the deepest essence of the South that you can imagine. It's kind of this perfect little southern town off the grid, off the main highway. And certainly you wouldn't go there unless you had a specific reason for being there. It's not a place that you pass through. And so it has like what most people would consider these southern charms of the small town America. But this was the Great Depression, so there was a lot of poverty going on. Kids went to school barefoot, often in homemade clothes. Girls often wore clothes made out of, old cotton sacks and things like that, kind of rejiggered into dresses. And so she was a real kind of southern country gal.
It seems so far away, doesn't it? That time in American history. When we picture it, it's hard to see it outside the frame of our flat-screen TVs. Author Greg Nery felt that way. So when he decided to write a book based on the childhoods of Nell Harper Lee and Truman Capote, he needed to see their hometown with his own eyes.
Her dad was, successful in terms of small town America, being a lawyer and also an editor for the local paper, a real community person who was kind of involved in every aspect. And she was always the daughter of A.C. Lee, her father. But what's always interesting about that kind of world is there's always a darker side to it. And the darkest side to it is, Great Depression, poverty, Deep South, the height of Jim Crow and segregation, and all kinds of kind of terrible things going on in the background, the rise of the Klan. The idea of growing up innocent or with innocent eyes in a time of great turbulence. There were all kinds of horrors going on around them, but here they were playing these games, pretending to be detectives and trying and living, an innocent child's life.
Harper Lee, or as her family called her, Nell, wasn't ahead of her time. She grew up surrounded by racism, segregation, and injustice. When she moved away and came back to visit, she began to see it from a different perspective. And though it took her 10 years, she was able to interpret all of those scary encounters into her most famous work, To Kill a Mockingbird. The book may seem dated, but it's more relevant than we realize. Welcome to A Life Lived. I'm Stephanie Okuknik. Nell Harper Lee was born in 1926. Her family was successful. Her father had his own law firm and acted up in several important roles within the community, including holding a seat in the state legislature. Nell and her siblings were well-educated, but they were raised in modesty. No southern plantation house or fancy dresses. Biographer Charles Shields got to know Nell's history well for his book.
When she was growing up in southern Alabama during the 1930s, it might as well have been 100 years before that. The average education among southerners at that time was 7th or 8th grade. Not many houses had phones. The public library had pretty slim pickings in Monroeville. There weren't many choices of books to be had. I think the library was in the upstairs of somebody's house. It was really an intellectually very stark and, I don't want to say backward, that's kind of unforgiving. That's not very pleasant, but it was a world in which a creative young person like herself would be starved for input, for stimulus. And consequently, that's why she and Truman Capote, the little boy next door, became best friends, because they were both imaginative and nonconformist. So as a result, their friendship was very deep.
Nell would be seen getting up to all sorts of mischief with Truman. In fact, it's impossible to tell the story of one without the other.
I mean, I kind of saw them as the original odd couple, you know, because she's kind of this tough as nails tomboy who doesn't take any guff from anybody. And he's this kind of prissy little city boy dressed in a little suit, and exact opposites. And she kind of became his protector because he was bullied so often. You know, her family kind of became his second family in a way, because her father was so grounded. And even though her mother kind of suffered from some form of depression, her family, her sisters, brother were much more grounded than Truman's family. The thing that bonded them was their mutual love of detective novels, in particular, you know, Sherlock Holmes. And they would often play detective where Truman would be Sherlock and Nell Harper Lee would be Dr. Watson. And there was Truman's cousin, Big Boy, who was the kind of the third peg of this triad. And they would go around solving small town mysteries together. And this is Harper Lee talking. "We had to use our own devices in our own play for our own entertainment. We didn't have much money. Nobody had any money. We didn't have toys. Nothing was done for us. So the result was that we lived in our imagination most of the time. We devised things. We were readers. We would transfer everything we had seen on the printed page to the backyard in the form of high drama. Did you never play Tarzan when you were a child? Did you never tramp through the jungle or refight the Battle of Gettysburg in some form or another? We did. Did you never live in a treehouse and find the whole world in the branches of a chinaberry tree? We did."
Their imagination ran wild. Nothing was out of their reach. They even built a freak show in Nell's garden using the remains of dead animals they found to display as exhibits. Their adventures were so bombastic, they had to be archived for future entertainment.
Nell's father gave them an old typewriter because they were always telling stories, and he, you know, convinced Truman he should start writing them down. And so they would kind of take turns at the typewriter. And really, I feel like Nell was a reluctant writer who was kind of drawn in just because of Truman's sheer energy at trying to, you know, capture these fantastical stories that they would make up. So they kept all those stories in a suitcase under Truman's bed. And the story is that his mother, Lily Mae, in a kind of a fit of, well, they had a very difficult relationship, and he felt that he never loved her. And in a fit, she burned all those stories because she knew that those were the things that he loved the most. So none of those stories exist today.
Truman's parents wanted more than rural Alabama, and they weren't the most present parents. So they sent Truman away for school. Nell and Truman grew distant, but they stayed good friends. When Truman was old enough to plant roots, the natural fit for him was the glitzy backdrop of New York. But he wasn't going to depart from his hometown without leaving a mark.
The famous showdown at the jailhouse in To Kill a Mockingbird between A.C. Lee and the Klan showing up was informed by this Halloween party that Truman threw. It was kind of his going away party. He was moving to New York with his mother, and they decided to throw one last big shindig. And his idea was, since he was leaving around Halloween, let's throw a big Halloween party. Now, his family didn't throw big, nobody threw big shindigs, but, you know, Truman had a very active imagination. He wanted to do it up in the biggest way possible. And that included inviting some of his Black childhood friends, which was definitely not a thing you did at that time. You did not first of all, you were not friends with black kids. And second of all, you didn't invite them over to the house, and definitely not for a big party. And he knew that, but his trick was, since it was a Halloween party, they could dress up in costumes and nobody would know the better. So that was his whole game. And they threw a very elaborate party at the house with all kinds of carnival-like games in the backyard. And one of his black childhood friends showed, you know, would come. And the character, the neighbor that eventually would inspire Boo Radley, you know, was a very shy person, didn't really want to go to the party, but eventually got into it, showed up dressed as a robot, meaning you couldn't see who it was. The Klan got word that, you know, black children were going to be at this white party and decided to make a show of it, a show of protest. And so everybody from the Klan kind of showed up en masse in their Klan outfits to that party. A.C. Lee was next door at the house, you know, got wind they were coming and, you know, stood out to kind of head them off. And there was a big showdown. That child who would become the Boo Radley character was thought to be a black child. And so they got a hold of him and they were going, you know, threatening to lynch him. And then, you know, the costume comes off and it's a white kid. And, you know, because Truman and Nell kind of got, you know, stood up to them as well, that kind of mob mentality dissipated in the way that it does in To Kill a Mockingbird. But what was supposed to be an outrageously fun party turned into this very traumatic event, you know, which is really par for the course for the lives of True and Nell, basically not being afraid to do what they want, even if they know it's going to cause some kind of big to do, and doing it anyways. And I always felt their attitude was, it was better to apologize after the fact than to ask permission to do it before the fact.
Nell was incredibly bright and knew she needed to leave Monroeville to get an education. The natural choice was to go to college and study law like her father and her sister. But her passion for writing just took over.
When she went to college, even though she went to study law, she naturally gravitated towards writing, and she became kind of the editor of the school yearbook and the school journal. And so there are pictures of her behind the typewriter in the college office, you know, newspaper office. And it's just kind of a perfect image of her, you know. And anytime I see her at the typewriter with a cigarette, you know, and just like her hair is out of control, and, you know, she's not, you know, I have a couple pictures of her wearing a dress and kind of dressed up with her hair perfect, and it seems so not her.
Nell had her degree now, and though she might have stayed put in Alabama, her sister made living there uncomfortable.
She was trying to get out from under the thumb of her elder sister, Alice. Alice became the head of the family after their mother passed away and their father wanted to retire from business. So Alice was more than a big sister to Nell. She was her tax accountant and her consultant and her legal advisor. So Nell wanted to get away from the oppression of her sister, and she could do that by living in New York. She arrived in her early 20s, and Truman had been there since he was about 12 or 13, something like that. But they reignited their friendship once she arrived in New York. For an entire 10 years, she was riding the subway to work as an airline reservationist. She had tried working in a bookstore for a while and found out that it was a lot of hard work that didn't pay. So she told people when they asked her, so what do? She'd say, well, I'm working on a book. And of course, in New York in the 1950s, that's a rather, you know, an eye roller of a remark to make. Yeah, you and who else? So many people are working on, you know, stories and things like that.
It's the age-old story. Girl chases her dream from a small town to the big city and hits the metaphorical wall. You're where you need to be, but how do you fulfill your creative destiny? Truman helped Nell make her dream a reality, and he relished parading her around lavish parties and introducing her to New York elite. She embraced this new life, but couldn't deny she was a bit of a fish out of water.
You know, Truman really enjoyed the role of being someone's best friend and someone who could problem solve for you. So he liked squiring his Alabama friend around to parties and social scenes and, you know, taking her backstage at productions, that sort of thing. So they were doing in New York what they did as children, which was living the most exciting life they could.
Well, I think she would never felt comfortable in Truman's circles with Truman's friends and that kind of New York socialite life. I think she preferred, you know, just to hang out with him and not that do the whole party scene that he would get involved with. And, you know, he would always complain that she still dressed like, you know, she was a old maid from the South, you know, and was always trying to get her to modernize herself. But she still remained a Southern girl to the end. I actually knew somebody who lived in her building like the whole time she was there, and she never knew it. That's how low key Harper Lee was, that this person lived in that building the whole time and never knew that Harper Lee was living in the same building. So, and she's very matter of fact, had a very regular kind of life, you know, going to Mets games and very simple things, you know, very simple pleasures. I feel it was Truman's bugging her all the time that Truman knew she had the mind of a writer. She didn't really believe in herself as a writer. And so it wasn't until actually friends of Truman's who kind of took her under their wing, gave her a Christmas present of supporting her for a year so that she could write this novel that she was always talking about. That she actually sat down and actually did it. But I feel she had, you know, she has had a very strong work ethic, was a very hard worker. So it seems like as soon as she realized what an enormous gift that was. And if somebody gives you, sacrifices something like that for you, then you give it 110%, and there's no way around it. You know, you're going to put everything into it.
Truman had heard through his contacts that Lippincott and Company was looking for authors, and they certainly were. They hadn't had a hit in years, hadn't had a bestseller. So Nell sent in her entire manuscript and then crossed her fingers and waited. And she received a call from the editorial offices saying, "We'd like to meet with you." She went in, met with Tay Hohoff and several other editors, and they told her that she had the potential for a good book here, but she needed help recrafting it. And to her eternal credit, she said, instead of saying, "Well, listen, I've done the best I can, and I've worked 10 years on this," she said, "Well, if you help me, I'll do it." And so they worked through the book together. And they extracted the strongest points of the book and wove them into a new novel, To Kill a Mockingbird.
Once Lippincott had the manuscript, Nell just had to wait to see what would happen next. She had some downtime, and her best friend needed some help. A horrific murder in Kansas was making national headlines, and Truman was traveling to the small farming community of Holcomb to write about it. What was intended to be a series of articles quickly evolved into much more, and Truman needed his down-to-earth friend to help him gain the trust of the community.
She ends up helping him on, you know, do research for In Cold Blood, And that's where you really see her work ethic, because that was real, like, detective work. People could see that she was the real thing and like a real person and not a big personality, that she was just, you know, there to do her job and get the facts and uncover the truth. Yeah, so that definitely made her more successful in terms of getting information from the people there. So this is Harper Lee talking about Truman. The crime intrigued him, and I'm intrigued with crime, and boy, I wanted to go. It was deep calling to deep.
They walked a fine line there. They wanted to get this story. Other people were competing for the story. No one should have the impression that Nell and Truman went out to Kansas and were the only ones out there. The place was just wild with reporters who were covering this. When in the days when a serial killing, and a killing of an entire family, was very unusual and frightening. So they were competing with other reporters, and Truman's genius was learning how to make people like him and learning how to make people feel important for being around him. So when Truman came into town, he was able to figure out who wanted to be in on the social scene, who wanted to say that they knew all about what was going on in New York, that kind of stuff, through Truman. So Truman began arranging parties. And without saying as much, there was always kind of a quid pro quo with Truman, which is that if he does something for you, there's an expectation that you will do something for him. After all, aren't we friends? So he added something. He didn't just take something from that little town. He added a kind of frisson, you know, that he brought with him as a New York literary light. So in return, they gave him access to things that other reporters didn't get. Through her, Truman was able to reach the people he needed to reach. The book, really, if there was any justice about the entire In Cold Blood experience, the book should have been called In Cold Blood by Truman Capote with Harper Lee.
I just loved that notion that, you know, two of our greatest writers who were doing that very thing in Kansas, you know, trying to uncover the mystery behind In Cold Blood that became the novel In Cold Blood. That's exactly what they did as children. And here they were doing it as adults.
Nell and Truman love a mystery. I love a mystery. And the sponsors who are visiting us may seem a bit mysterious to you, but rest assured, when we get back, all will be revealed. Hey, everybody. How you doing? It's crazy, right? Do you feel a little bit boxed in with lockdown, pandemic, uncertainty? I don't blame you. There's so much clouding our happiness, our security, our structure. It's gone. And you know, there's so many other things also that are frozen in time. Do you feel like you can't move forward? You can't achieve the goals that you set out for yourself? I don't blame you. But there's help out there. In fact, that's what I want to tell you about. Our sponsor, BetterHelp. BetterHelp will sit down with you, assess your needs, and they're going to match you with a licensed professional therapist. And you can work with them in under 48 hours. You can then log on to an account that you set up with BetterHelp anytime. And you can schedule weekly video counseling sessions or telephone sessions. You can also send a message to your counselor and get really quick responses that are going to listen to you. They're going to work with you. This isn't a crisis line. This is not self-help. It's professional counseling done securely online. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional counseling, and financial aid is available. And BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. So head over to betterhelp.com/lived and get a 10% discount off your first month of therapy. That's betterhelp.com/lived. Over 1 million people have turned to BetterHelp so that they can take charge of their mental health. And you can too, with an experienced professional. Find out more at betterhelp.com. Take care of yourselves. Nell may have been in the shadows of Holcomb, Kansas, but her book's popularity was spreading faster than wildfire.
The book started selling very rapidly when it came out in the spring of 1960, shot up to the bestseller lists, and then Nell was in demand. By that time, Truman had enough in his notes that he had to get down to the business of writing an outline and, you know, filling in the holes, figuring out what questions he needed to ask next time he went out to Kansas.
Nell returned to New York and unexpectedly was greeted by fame.
So now it's Nell's turn, and Nell does radio programs, and she's very accommodating. When she realized that she was famous, she also came to understand the price of that, which is that people want access to you and want you to be something. And she didn't want to be anything to anybody. She just wanted to be true to herself. She has the courage to say no when she doesn't want to do something. She just said no. Also, you know where you stand with her. She's blunt. She's always frank. And she doesn't seem to want anything from anybody. She is appreciative or grateful for friendship. She's grateful for good conversation. She likes to laugh. But beyond that, she doesn't rely on other people for emotional support.
To Kill a Mockingbird is a tribute to Nell's father, her hometown, and the childhood that may have been far away, but never left her.
She often described To Kill a Mockingbird as a love letter. And it's a love letter to her father. It's a tribute to her father. I don't think she really cared whether she became popular. What mattered to her was to get a book on the shelf that told the truth about her father, who was a great man in a small town.
Nell was humble in her newfound success. But whenever Truman and Nell went to a party, all the focus shifted from Truman's work on In Cold Blood to Nell's success with To Kill a Mockingbird. And Truman was not a fan of sharing the spotlight.
The jealousy that he had towards her success just on the first book being that successful and winning the Pulitzer when his book did not, you know, and, you know, those books basically running neck and neck in the 60s, and then the movies, subsequent movies that followed also had the same kind of thing. Like In Cold Blood was a massive critical hit, but To Kill a Mockingbird was like beloved, you know, Gregory Peck. And it's just like, no matter how successful Truman was, I feel that that always ate at him. Whereas, you know, Nell had no problem with his success, other than it went to his head. But, you know, outside of how it affected his personality, you know, I felt like she would want him to be a successful writer.
To Kill a Mockingbird did so well because it held a mirror to the segregation and racism of the South in the 1930s and was still happening at that time in the 1960s when it was released. It's a book that has been a staple in school curriculums for decades, and now it raises even more questions for its readers.
At one time, it stood for a portrait of America, but now it's also beginning to show signs of sort of cracks in the mirror. What I mean is, it's very paternalistic. The African Americans in the book are two-dimensional. You have, you know, as we read it now, we wonder who takes care of the housekeeper's children while she's there all the time chasing Scout and Jim around. Who's watching her children? And she does have a family. And the accused man, the man who's accused of raping Mayella, he's kind of a cutout figure, you know. He's just a man in overalls who's poor. We don't learn much about him. So on the one hand, it's a portrait of an era, but it also increasingly reveals more than even Nell was aware of when she wrote it. Some of the prejudices of herself come through in that book. She's not entirely distant from some of the, you know, failures of that society. The novel is a cultural artifact of a time and a place, and it's beginning to show us more than what she intended to show us about the South and about the author too. Living in New York gave her a perspective that was necessary to write To Kill a Mockingbird. And while I don't think it's as powerful a book any longer when it talks about racism, it is powerful if you teach it on the topic of othering people. So if you want to make the book continue to live and be vital, you really have to approach it as a good discussion starter about how do we get along.
Nell and Truman were never as close as they were ever again, but they were still a staple in each other's lives.
During the period where Truman released some of the early stories from the famous last book that he never finished and kind of upset the whole New York social scene and became a pariah, he was to do an interview with People magazine and was so kind of overcome by the hatred of his former New York friends that he locked himself in a bathroom and refused to come out until Nell came to talk to him. And so Nell gets a call like out of the blue, and she hasn't talked to Truman for years perhaps, and Truman has locked himself in the bathroom and won't come out until you come down here kind of thing. So she was still like the go-to deep friendship despite everything else falling apart around him. You know, she was like his last go-to person in the world.
There is no greater pressure for an artist than matching your great success with a follow-up. For Nell, it was doubly difficult because her first book was her magnus opus. And once you climb Everest, where do you go from there?
She wrote a couple of essays for popular magazines, coffee table type magazines, about what Christmas meant to her. And that was sort of a page out of To Kill a Mockingbird. She was talking about what Christmas was like in her little Alabama town. And then she wrote an essay for a women's magazine about what she would show children if she took them to Washington, what's important, what symbols are important. But I think she found the public speaking circuit exhausting. And also she began to develop a problem with drinking. And so she isolated herself, from the glare of expectation. What are you working on now? How's the next novel coming?
For a person of such simple upbringing and kind of low-key, humble lifestyle to write what would end up being one of the pivotal works of fiction in American literature must have been such an unbelievable burden personally. Like, probably very proud that the book was able to capture so many eyes, but then to have to live with it for the rest of your life, you know, I can imagine how difficult it must have been for her.
And even after all of her hard work, support, and contribution for In Cold Blood, she never got any acknowledgement for it.
Well, I think she was hurt that she wasn't given more credit for In Cold Blood. I mean, after all, Truman went on talk shows, and when he was asked about Nell's participation, he would say things like, well, it was good to have her there, you know, it was nice to have her along, as if she was kind of his minder, you know. And I think she thought, well, what the heck? All I need is a topic, and I can do that on my own. I know how to do that. I've done it.
Nell had the experience and the hunger for true crime, so she chased a case to potentially become the foundation of her next novel.
And definitely, you know, with her other project that never came out, was also a crime story that required the same level of research and detective work. So it was definitely an ongoing thing.
She found something not far away over in Eufaula, and somewhere, I think it was around there, about the Reverend being accused of murder, and she followed up on that. It was never really clear to the people who helped her why she stopped working on it. The lawyer who represented the Reverend accused of murder, Tom Radney, gave her everything that he had, his files, transcripts, interviews, depositions. So she had, you know, all the paper material. She had the paper trail to do the book, but she just stopped working on it.
Probably the biggest thing was just the shadow of To Kill a Mockingbird was so great that she knew that didn't matter what she wrote, that it would never compare, never equal, you know, the level of success and acclaim that her first book reached. But I just feel like in the end, she couldn't bring herself to finish it and face that kind of critical judgment.
She got royalties from the movie, and she got royalties from the book. And when the book is being read in 60% of the public high schools across the nation, you know, baby boomers are reading the To Kill a Mockingbird. She made a tremendous amount of money from that book.
A Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, an Oscar-winning film. Everybody is going to want a piece of the person responsible for that. And after a while, it's just exhausting. So Nell decided to take herself out of the limelight and live quietly again.
The idea that you would become this kind of obsessive focus of fandom is kind of the exact opposite of kind of every moral fiber of her being, I think. And so while she desperately wanted the book to be widely read, it just became so much more than that, that it became really invasive on her life. And so she just had to withdraw for her own sanity.
Reclusive sounds like you are taking steps not to be seen. It was relatively easy what she did. She just refused requests for interviews. She didn't make herself available for television or radio, not very much, not after the book was published. And if you don't make access available to yourself, it seems like you're being reclusive. But she was all over Monroeville. Everybody knew who she was. She was just a local lady.
If she was starting out as a writer today, she would probably hate it because, you know, you have to do everything you can to kind of capture a little space in the public eye, and that means getting out there yourself, doing interviews and doing personal appearances and all that stuff that she hated. So I don't know that she would have, how she would have survived today.
Writers are notoriously inclusive people. Nell lived a private life and had no need for extravagant things. She was content with simplicity, even in her private life. Her only known relationships are between her family and friends. There is no record of a partner or a lover.
I always feel like there was some kind of secret relationship going on with somebody, but You know, and there are little things here and there, but nothing of record. I mean, Truman always alluded to that. There was something going on in her private life. Just some little jabs at Nell and her secret life, perhaps. But I do imagine that, I mean, I could see her as somebody who never had a fulfilling personal, intimate relationship.
Her sexual identity was very vague, or she wasn't aware of that aspect of herself. You know, it's an irony that while she was authentic and never tried to be anything beyond what she was, when it came to her sexual identity, it was very fuzzy around the edges. And I did try to establish this. I didn't go after this hard because I just didn't see it as necessary to tell the story of To Kill a Mockingbird. But when I would talk to friends and people who were close to her, it was never really clear whether she was gay or how she felt about men, if she was ever in love, whom she was, you know, really, really close to. I don't know. I don't know whether she was conflicted, or it's just that she admired her father so much that she never thought any other person outside of him could mean that much to her. He was her ideal in terms of a person to love. Truman said that she had a crush on a professor in college, and it was unrequited, and she was hurt. But, you know, Truman loved telling whoppers. Truman loved telling stories, so never mind what he says about something like that. And Truman's aunt said that she didn't like going over to Nell's apartment because Nell's lady friends were over there, and Truman's aunt didn't approve of the kinds of ladies that they were. I guess maybe they were gay. So it's not clear what her sexual identity was. And it's, you know, it's concerning to me when a person goes through life alone, and I wonder how she managed that.
Nell was living comfortably and didn't need the New York scene to fulfill her dream any longer. It was time to go home.
She ended up splitting her time between New York and Monroeville most of her adult life, but it was when she became sick later on in life that she kind of stopped going back to New York and just ended up staying with her sister, and they became roommates till the end, until she moved into the home in her last years.
Nell always had her original manuscript of To Kill a Mockingbird and toyed with the idea of publishing it. Her controlling sister Alice wouldn't hear of it.
The relationship between herself and Alice was very interesting to me, that despite what a tough cookie Nell Harper Lee was, she still could be intimidated by her sister, who was half her size. Alice bossed her around, and Nell took it. And Nell never published Go Set a Watchman during Alice's lifetime because Alice didn't want her to.
Nell would spend her downtime putting, watching ball games, and having a chinwag over her coffee spot.
She was into golfing, and golfing, there was a golf course nearby, and I guess like any good lawyer, her father knew how to golf, maybe to mingle with clients or I don't know what, but she kind of took to golfing at an early age, and I think she played into adulthood. So it's always like interesting to me to imagine Harper Lee golfing, but there it is. You can imagine her fishing, and she did that, and I could see that. Oh, well, the other big thing was in her old age, she loved to go to McDonald's to drink the coffee. And so you could often find her and her sister Alice at McDonald's drinking coffee.
Nell's sister passed away in 2014. And she was finally free to release one last book.
Alice was gone. And what do you know, 4 months after Alice passes away, Nell's lawyer opens up the safety deposit box in the bank that holds the manuscript and pretends as if it was discovered when they knew it was there all along. It was done. She didn't have to do anything to it. Nell didn't have to do anything to it. And what publisher wouldn't want to bring out another book by Harper Lee? So the book went to press pretty much as is. People seem to embrace it. I mean, 11,000 reviews on Amazon, 3.5 stars isn't that bad, you know, for a novel. Pretty good. So I don't think Nell really was inspired to bring it out. She just acquiesced. Why not? Let's do it.
Ghost at a Watchman was met with mixed reviews. It was bound to happen. You can't match what is considered to be one of America's literary masterpieces without intense debate. But it must have been a relief to Nell to finally have it out there.
If you look at, you know, how she shaped the Watchmen book, and then the difference between that and To Kill a Mockingbird, like just the idea of rejiggering an idea that dramatically, I mean, that's a complete rehaul and a complete different kind of direction than she originally anticipated doing. That takes real effort and a willingness to kind of not be so precious about your ideas, but to listen to what your editor tells you is, you know, not everybody can do that. I think in the end, she came around and kind of relished the idea of upsetting the hardcore To Kill a Mockingbird fan. I feel like there's always a rebel part of her, and any point she could kind of jab her finger into and upset the status quo, especially if something so beloved and so sacred as this To Kill a Mockingbird was, the idea of showing a different side of her father and a different reality that was portrayed in that book probably made her smile a little.
Nell Harper Lee died February 19th, 2016. Author Greg Neri was about to send his manuscript to her when he found out she passed away.
When I did have a finished manuscript, I was going to send it to her. I had it packaged up, addressed, and I was on my way to the post office when I got a call that she died that morning. She's just passed away. Things are very, you know, fresh. Like, I went to the cemetery and her grave was so simple, like still freshly dug. There was no headstone. There was no marker or anything, just a few flowers on it. And it was like right next to this road. There was nothing remarkable about her death spot. You know, you would think like she would have this giant memorial, a statue or something. And it was so humble and simple that it really kind of framed for me who she was. Just like very matter of fact, didn't want any celebration, didn't want any, you know, big memorial. It's just like, that's it. Show's over. And then just being in Monroeville for those few days was pretty remarkable to be able to walk in, you know, to visit where their homes were, where they lived as next door neighbors. And it's completely different now. It's that whole street is just a big, ugly industrial street. Truman's home is no longer there, but the foundation is still there. And so you can see exactly where the house was, where the rooms were. And because I had done so much research, I knew exactly, oh, this is where Truman slept. Here's the little goldfish pond. This is where the kitchen was. Here are the flowers that his cousin Jenny planted that are flowering. Here's the wall that separated their property that, you know, they would do somersaults on. And here are the twin chinaberry trees where they had their playhouse. You know, this is the forest behind the house where he and Sook would collect herbs for her secret dropsy medication. And where Harper's house was is just like what would be kind of like a frosty freeze kind of establishment, you know, and there's no marker there. There's no plaque that says here lived Harper Lee. And that's, you know, that's kind of, she probably insisted that there not be a plaque there. So it's kind of, it was a very interesting experience. And then to spend time in the courthouse, you know, alone with that room, not only to sit where her father, A.C. Lee, sat at that same table that he would argue his cases, but then to go up into the balcony where she and True would sit and watch his cases was just like a very intimate way to kind of touch history and touch their lives and physically see, you know, their world. I mean, that courthouse is exactly the way it was when she was growing up.
The courthouse has a very special magic about it. When you go in, you feel like you're entering a church. People automatically fall into a whisper. It's a sacred place in terms of what it means to us as a nation ruled by law and one that's always trying to seek the ideal of justice. Commensurate symbols in America are, say, the Lincoln Memorial or Lincoln's house in Springfield. But that's what the courthouse is like in Monroeville. It's ground zero for what it means to believe in American ideals.
Will the defendant please rise and face the jury? What is your verdict?
We find the defendant guilty as charged.
Certainly the fact that to this day, almost every American student is required to read this book. And the reason is its humanity, I feel, as a way to take what has become a cliche, you know, the Deep South, the small town Deep South, stories about the Klan, and, you know, bring great humanity to them in a way, you know, to tell the story through a child's eyes is a very powerful way to tell a story about, you know, segregation and the Deep South in a way that kind of everybody can have a common talking point.
What Harper Lee is to me is one of the fine novelists of the 20th century who wrote a book that was well timed and sparked a controversy, a discussion that needed to be held as the civil rights movement was building in strength. To Kill a Mockingbird is to the 20th century what Huckleberry Finn was to the 19th.
Greg Neri is the author of True and Nell. You can find a full list of his work and a documentary he made about his trip to Monroeville, Alabama, on his website, www.gregneri.com. Charles Shields is a biographer. You can find his book, Mockingbird, A Portrait of Harper Lee, on Amazon. Next, on A Life Lived.
He saw clothes, how they would move. He also, both he and Balenciaga, they had certain unique and beautiful details. Collars curved away from the neck. They were not flat. And his clothes were so easy to wear. And he understood what people needed in their wardrobes. And that some of his clients, like me, wanted to keep wearing them for a long time.
He was laughed at when he said he wanted to design clothes. But Hubert de Givenchy's style, technique, and couture would dress stars like Princess Grace of Monaco and Audrey Hepburn and make his name synonymous with beauty. we spoke with his close friend, socialite philanthropist Dita Blair, about his first atelier and watching the designer work. This is an Audioboom original production by Muddy Knees Media and Breaking Stereotypes. This podcast was presented and executive produced by me, Stephanie Okukniak. Our series editor has been Lucy Oliva. If there is an icon that you would like to know more about, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @alifelived_.